I think we determined that today is May 6th. No, June 6th, 2003. I'm Bill Schneider. Pleasure today of talking with Dick Madsen, so thanks for taking the time to do this.
My pleasure.
Let's start by having you talk a little bit about your parents and where you grew up and a little bit of your background.
Okay. Let's see. Parents. My father was Leo Madsen, and he was English, German, Scotch, Irish, that type of background. And I grew up in northern Minnesota in an iron mining community in Hibbing, which incidentally is the hometown of Bob Dylan, even though he doesn't claim it. But anyway, I grew up there, and my father's side of the family were middle class. I guess my grandfather started out as a barber, and he finally went into the mining business and became a manager for one of the mines there in northern Minnesota, one of the iron mines. And for those people who aren't familiar with the mining area I came from, it's a lot of immigrants. And over the years, various countries sent people over here. It was a real mixture of all kinds of ethnic backgrounds. And usually the last one that came was the bottom of the pecking order, and that's where my mother came in. She was Slovenian, and her father was born in Slovenia, and her mother, and then my mother's mother died when my mother was only 13. And they had a large family. They had, I think, seven or eight kids, and she was one of the oldest and helped raise them. But getting back to my point was that when my father and she got married, it was something that wasn't done very often. In other words, someone from the higher strata of society and the mining community marrying a Slovenian second-generation immigrant. And I think it caused a lot of dissension on my father's, both his parents, and I don't think they truly accepted my mother for years. But anyway, we grew up, and my father was a foreman for Oliver Mining Company, which was a subsidiary of U.S. Steel. He was what they called a drilling and blasting foreman. He was the one responsible for drilling the holes in the ground in the open pit mines and filling them with explosives and blowing it up. And he did that for a number of years. My mother basically stayed at home and raised us kids. And it was a nice time to grow up, and it was a nice town to grow up in. In my high school years, Eisenhower was president, the Korean War was over, there was a recession, but prosperity kind of came back again, and for kids growing up in a small town, it was really nice. It was a town about the size of Fairbanks, actually, maybe 18,000 people. And just a lot of fond memories. In fact, I'm going back next month to my 50th high school reunion there, and I'm looking forward to it. I still have some old friends that we still keep in contact with and see each other, once or twice a year. So it's, I don't know what else I can say about it. It was just a good time, and I truly enjoyed growing up there and in that particular period in time.
What were some of the values that your parents gave you as you were growing up?
Number one, I guess, was just hard work, just working. I started working when I was, 13 years old, and shoveling walks and mowing lawns and doing things you don't see kids doing anymore. Then I was 14 when I worked summers at a resort up on the Canadian border, which was very pretty much in the middle of nowhere in those days. It was strictly a fishing resort, and did not have electricity, didn't have anything. It was owned by, Mr. Olson, and his wife, and they catered to basically fishermen and families that came up and rented a cabin and went fishing every day. But it was a lot of work. It was, he worked 7 days a week, and I got $50 a month, which wasn't much money, and at the end of the summer I came home. I usually didn't have any money, but I had an experience that you just couldn't get anywhere else. I learned an awful lot. I learned carpentry from him. I learned plumbing. I learned just a little bit of everything. And we didn't think about days off or, you know, things. It never entered my mind. So I learned that just working and doing a good job was very important. And I used to shovel the walk for the guy next door who had was president of a small savings and loan association. And anyway, one day, you know, he paid me, and I tried to do a good job for him. And then I was a senior in high school, and he said, what are your plans? And I said, well, I don't know. I don't have much money, but I'm planning on going on to school, probably University of Minnesota. And he said, oh, how would you like to go to a military academy? And I thought, what is he talking about? And as it turns out, he had a lot of political pull and could get me appointed to any of the academies. So And the only reason for that is he says, I've been watching you, and he says, I like the way you work. When it snows, you're out here and you do the job. And that, I guess that taught me something, that people do appreciate somebody when they just do a good job. So anyway, I didn't end up going to the academies, but my point was that he just noticed that when somebody does a decent job, there's, I guess, a reward there. And so it made me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they taught me, basically, I think, was they never really sat around and said, you know, we never talked much about plans or what us kids were going to do, my brother, my sister, or I. It just was assumed I was going to college when I finished high school. We never talked about it. I just guess that was the way it was going to be. My father was had an appointment to the military academy, actually, and didn't go, because he got married instead, and he quit college after 2 years, and he really regretted not finishing school. And I think, while it wasn't said in so many words, I think that value was really instilled in us that we're going to go on and get the best education we possibly can.
Mm-hmm. How about your education?
Well, after high school, I, of course, didn't have any... Well, I did apply to the United States Merchant Marine Academy, because they paid you... In addition to being one of the service academies, they actually paid you a little stipend of $50 a month, which the other academies didn't. And the most important reason was that when you came out and graduated, you got a commission in the U.S. Navy, but it was in the reserve. So you did not have to go and spend 2 years in the regular Navy, which I didn't want to do. But in those days, you had to pass a very, very strict physical, and one of the requirements was 20/20 uncorrected vision. And I went down to Minneapolis. I had passed everything. It was all set. Had the eye exam to go, and one eye wouldn't pass me. So that was the end of that. And you always wonder, what if? You know, what if I'd gone there? And nowadays, the U.S. merchant fleet is practically non-existent, and you know, the industry doesn't even exist anymore. So I guess fate has a wonderful way of deciding what you're going to do and where you end up. So anyway, to make a long story short, or at least shorter, I spent 2 years at Hibbing Junior College, which is just a two-year school there in my hometown, which I didn't want to do, but not having any money, I had grand illusions of going to Dartmouth or Yale or some great school like that, and brought home all the brochures. And my dad looked over my shoulder one day and he says, what's with those? And I said, well, I was thinking of going to school one of these places. He says, well, how are you going to do that? I said, well, I thought that's kind of where you came from, you came in. And he says, no, I don't think so. I think you better consider something really close to home, like right here. So I did. So after 2 years at the junior college, I then went to University of Minnesota at Minneapolis, main campus, and I was taking taking chemical engineering, and I switched to mining engineering and graduated in 1958 after a five-year program there in mining engineering. And I didn't go to law school for another 4 years, yeah, before I went back to school.
Why did you decide to go to law school?
Well, after I finished as a mining engineer, there was another recession. It seemed to be my luck. Mining jobs weren't easy to get, and I got a job with a company called Bucyrus Erie that manufactured large mining equipment, drills, big shovels, you know, drag lines, things like this. And then I was in South Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Then they moved me to Richmond, Indiana, and then back to Milwaukee again. And it was a lot of, at my job, I was a field engineer, and it was a lot of travel. By this time, we had two kids, and I think third on the way, yeah. And the travel was getting really hard, so I switched jobs to a company out of Dallas, security engineering division, because it was promised, I was promised less travel, at least travel within a smaller area. Well, that didn't work out, and my travel increased. I was based in back in Hibbing. I had a choice of where I could go, and because a large part of their business was right there in the, what we call the Iron Range, I chose to go right back to my hometown. But I spent most of my time in either Northern Ontario or Pennsylvania or New York, which didn't make a bit of sense, but that's the way companies operated. So, get back to your point. I know I'm rambling here, but...
No, you're doing fine.
Anyway, to make that decision, my wife was not happy. I was not happy. It was just I was on the road driving long, long hours. And I used to drive from Northern Ontario, Capriol, which had a mine, iron mine there, which was almost exactly 1,000 miles from my home, and I would drive it nonstop. And I was driving across northern Michigan in the winter, in a snowstorm, where you could hardly see, and I kept thinking, there's got to be something better than this. I've got to do something that is just better than what I'm doing. And I remembered back at the university that our School of Mines was right next to the law school. And I had no idea what lawyers did. I couldn't have even guessed what they did, but they always looked good. They always looked clean and nice, you know, and we looked pretty grubby in the School of Mines there. And I thought, you know, maybe that's what I'd like to do. So I kind of made that decision and at least look into it. And as it turned out, it was a fateful and very, very lucky decision that I did. So I contacted a school in St. Paul, which is William Mitchell College of Law. And at that time, they had both a day program and a night program where you could go to night school, work full-time, and go to night school for 4 years and get a law degree, which I would have to do. There was no question about it. And I was also fortunate in getting a job in mining engineering with the Department of Interior Bureau of Mines. Had a research center in Minneapolis. And I got a job there, so I was able to go to school full time and work. So I was able to, you know, we had a good life. And in those days, it was just amazing. I went through 4 years of college working at the same time and got out and didn't owe a dime anything. You paid as you went. Tuition wasn't as exorbitant as nowadays. You know, now nobody gets out of school without owing a lot of money to somebody, unless they have rich parents. And it just was very fortunate that I was able to be able to do it at that time, and it worked out real well.
Yeah, why did you say it was a good decision?
Because I loved what I ultimately ended up doing. You know, it worked out so nicely with both a job in the same field I was in and going to night school, which, you know, I was able to do rather than having to quit and just go straight days, which I just couldn't have done. Mm-hmm.
Tell us what happened then after you got out of law school.
Well, my goals were always short-sighted. You know, like going to law school, it was, okay, I'm in school. I still didn't know what lawyers did. And when I graduated, I still didn't know what they did. Never was in a courtroom. But I wanted to graduate. And then the next step was, well, you got to pass the Minnesota bar exam. So I studied for that, passed the Minnesota bar. And then step three is got to find a job. By this time, because I was paid pretty well as a research engineer. We had a house in the suburbs, and my wife had a little business in another suburb there near 10 miles away or so. And we had a good life. You know, two cars, four-bedroom house, everything was great, and the guys. So it became time to look for work, and I found the only jobs available were downtown Minneapolis, which is a place I didn't want to be. I didn't like cities. and hope she picks that up. And I can pull that out too. But
yeah.
Anyway, I didn't want to do that, and you know, I was contemplating where we're going to work and what I was going to do. And at that time, I was sent to Fairbanks with the Department of Interior for come up here on a trip. You know, I was here for a week, and my first impression of Fairbanks, and this was in 1967. Was that this place is the armpit of the world. I mean, of course, it was right after the flood. It was that spring right after the flood of 67. And the snow was just melting. It was like in April, I guess. Yeah, it must have been April. And it really looked bad. And I thought, this place is terrible. But in the week, I met some nice people here, really good people. And, you know, I really liked it. I liked everything. So I went back and I told my wife, I said, I really like it up there. And I said, you know, I think, you know, how would it be if we just went up there? And she said, well, she was all for it. So we sold our house, sold both cars, bought a truck, big van, a used big furniture van, and a station wagon, and piled all three kids in there and all the furniture we could carry, and headed north. And I drove in the truck. Well, she had the kids, and I drove with a poodle that had our little poodle that had diarrhea most of the way up the Elkan, if I remember. Oh, what a not pleasant.
Yeah.
But we just came up here, and as they say, the rest is history.
Well, let's get into the rest there. What did you find when you got here in terms of work and?
There weren't many lawyers here in town then. I don't think there were more than, gosh, I want to say 15 maybe at the most. And so there wasn't a great area to pick from. I mean, there wasn't a lot of, you know. But anyway, I just kind of went door to door, hat in hand, and knocking on different doors and talking to people. And I could have worked for one firm, but I was a little hesitant because it wasn't the kind of practice that I think I wanted to do. So I ended up talking to a gentleman by the name of Warren Taylor, who was probably in his 80s by that time. And Warren had come to Valdez in 1917 and walked to Fairbanks because he heard there was more money to be made up here. Found out that wasn't true and walked back to Valdez again. He had, you know, he had virtually no money. Then he was drafted in the Army in the First World War, came back to Alaska again and moved to Fairbanks and became one of the representatives at the Territorial Convention, and he served in the Territory Legislature and in the State Legislature for a number of years. A great guy. He could not say no to anybody that needed help. And so I started working for him, but he never discussed money. And, excuse me,
let's unplug it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, just unplug that thing.
I'm running off with not thinking here, too. This one here?
Yep. Probably on the back. No, that just, you know.
If I unplug the power,
it should. It shouldn't ring now. Let's hope so.
Yeah, so this is an important story here. We're talking about Warren Taylor.
Yeah, he's the guy I was talking about earlier that just should have. Oh, I just wish he'd recorded stuff. He just had a wealth of stories of those old days.
And you said he couldn't say no, huh?
No. Every old timer that came in there, you know, he would end up representing him. But unfortunately, the time I started working for him, he was getting pretty senile. And anyway, I never knew what I was going to get paid, and he wouldn't discuss it. You know, it was just, we just couldn't talk about it. And finally, his secretary, who had been with him for years and years, she finally took me aside and says, look, he never will discuss it. It just, you know, money just doesn't mean anything to him. He doesn't even know what he, she said, what do you think you should get paid? And I said, well, I don't know, whatever law clerks are getting paid, whatever the standard rate is. So we kind of figured out something. And then she says, now I'll give you the bad news. There isn't any money. He takes all these cases and he never gets paid. So she said, we'll just have to figure something out. So at the end of the month, we used to arm wrestle, flip coins or whatever it took. And she was terrific. She could get on the phone and get money from people that was owed to Mr. Taylor. And we always managed to get paid something, you know. And I'll tell you, she was just a great gal and very sharp. And she ran his whole practice, basically, because he was getting very forgetful.
Did you give us her name?
You know, I'm trying to think of it. It was at that time Schneider. I'd have to go back and search my memory to.
It may come up.
She later became the probate master here for the court system. God, I just would have to rethink of it.
So your job with Warren was your first job here, huh?
My first job. Yeah, I was a clerk for him, and you know, and I'm a young attorney. I don't know anything, right? And he gives me this assignment, I got to do this appeal. And I'm doing this appeal, and I'm thinking, there's nothing here. I mean, there's no issue that the higher court is going to look at and reverse. Just nothing. But I couldn't talk to him about it. He just rubbed blank. His client was railroaded and got a raw deal, and that was all. That was the only thing he wanted to hear. And his son, Bill Taylor, William Taylor, became a Superior Court judge here. And he used to just go to court. Warren used to go to court and come back if he was in front of his son. Just madder than the dickens. And he said, I taught that damn kid better than that. And I don't know, because, you know, they were very tolerant of Warren. He was forgetful, and he had trouble keeping focused on what he was doing. And then the best part was he had his wife had died. Third wife, I think it was. You know, Lamita Subdivision was originally Gridell Lee, that's where the Lee came from, and then I forget who that was, and then the TA was Taylor. He was married to Gridell Lee at that time, and they put all the Lamita Subdivision together. She was a realtor, and Taylor, I don't know what he did. He did the legal work, I suppose. But the interesting thing about that was he and Gridell Lee got a divorce, and it was just a classic story where, you know, she was testifying in court about Mr. Taylor's sexual appetite and how he used to chase her around the house in his underwear, you know, when he was feeling a little amorous. Anyway, she told this long, elaborate story while she's testifying, and all of a sudden Mr. Taylor, who's 80 years old, stands up and he just bows. He's, thank you, Gridell. Oh, he was just a classic guy. He was a very, very funny guy. But he had this beagle, and it was the fattest beagle. The thing looked like a pig. I mean, it just was as big around as you can imagine, you know, just huge thing. And it had little short legs. And we were in the Nerland building there in the, you know, at that time, and they had a linoleum floor. And he'd come into work in the morning, or he'd show up about 9 o'clock, leading his dog, trying to remember the name of the dog. I don't remember it for sure, but anyway, leading the dog on this leash, and the dog is just going like crazy on this linoleum trying to get going, and he's, whoa, whoa, god damn it, whoa, whoa. And finally they come, both of them come in the office, and the dog's panting like crazy, you know. And then he used to take it to court. In those days, you know, the judges allow him to take it to court. The dog would be under the counsel table there sleeping and snoring. So anyway, Judge Hepp, Everett Hepp was the judge, one of the judges at that time, told Warren, he says, you know, he says, Mr. Taylor, you're going to have to leave the dog outside. He said, we just can't have this. So Warren reluctantly took the dog out and tied him right outside to the doorknob of the door to the courtroom. And of course, the dog started to howl, as only a beagle can do. He's howling like crazy. Howl, howl. But Hepp said, okay, Mr. Taylor, bring the dog back in. And he was, anyway, I worked for him for a couple of years, and now there's all kinds of Warren Taylor stories. I mean, they were just, he was he was something else, but he unfortunately just was, he couldn't give up. We tried to get him to retire. His secretary tried to get him to retire. I tried, we tried, the Bar Association tried. We finally threw a retirement party for him, and he, because he said he was going to retire. And the bar convention was in Nome, so the state bar got a ticket for him. I took him to the airport, put him on the plane, and he was going to go there, and it was part of his retirement, you know, farewell thing at the convention. Well, I had hardly sooner got back to the office when he almost beat me back. He flew to Nome, got off, looked around, and got back on the plane, and flew back to Fairbanks because he didn't like it. didn't care for it.
Oh, my.
So he stayed on for a while and ultimately died. But next wife, I guess his last wife, died during the flood, 67 flood. And she was an artist, Claire Taylor. I don't know what her maiden name was. And she was very good. In fact, I've still got a couple of her paintings. But one of them was, he had in his office for years, and I ultimately ended up with it because I just love it. And it's a painting of nothing more than a sheet tacked on, it's a sheet tacked up to something, a little couple of thumbtacks. And, you know, you look at it and you say, well, why is anybody, you know, why would anybody paint this? And he said, well, his wife was painting him something for his birthday. And he never knew what it was. She kept it covered. He could never look at it. She said, I want it to be a surprise. Well, it turns out she didn't like what she had painted, so she just quickly painted this, what do you call it, over it. And then she died, and Warren, he brings tears to his eyes every time he looked at it. He says, you know, to this day, I don't know what's behind that sheet. And I thought that was just so neat that I got that painting today, and I just really, it's a good memento to have. But anyway, I suffered with Warren, or he suffered with me, for a couple of years. And then in 1969, they started the statewide public defender system, and I was hired to be the first public defender in Fairbanks. Second one in the state, first one in Fairbanks. And then I worked for the state, for the public defender, for 5 years. Lots of interesting times, you know, and those were the days we had good criminals. I can call them good. They were interesting criminals. And so I worked there for 5 years, but it's a tough job. It's one of the hardest jobs I've ever had because of the immense amount of responsibility. Too many cases, not enough time, and anyway, I had never tried a case in my life when all of a sudden I'm a public defender and I got to represent this guy and we go to court the next day for a jury trial. I'd never been in a jury trial, but in those days, that's the way you did it. You walked in and did it. You didn't have anybody to teach you. You just learned. And the nice thing, you know, another nice thing about that time was when I finished that case, I was back in my office, and the phone rang, and the secretary said, it's Judge Hepp. He wants you to come over there right away. And I thought, oh, geez. I mean, for a young green attorney to be called in by the judge, who was the judge who tried that case, I mean, I was scared to death. I couldn't imagine what he wanted.
This was your first case?
My first case. And he brings me into his chambers, you know, and Judge Hepp was a very, you know, kind of a strict gentleman, you know, went by the book and everything. But anyway, all he wanted was to give me a little critique about how I did in my first case and suggestions and things. And I thought, you know, that's so darn nice. You know, you don't see that anymore. But that was just, he just liked to help out young attorneys.
Do you remember what he said?
He said I was nervous, but he said that was understandable. He said, but he liked my presence. He said your courtroom presence was good. He said, once you get some experience, he says, you won't be, you know, that nervousness will go away. And he said, you'll do just fine. But mainly he was just trying to get yourself calm and, you know, to not get too excited about things. And yeah, I don't remember all the details, but it was just a nice talk that he had. It was a very encouraging talk, and it made me feel a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that wouldn't happen today.
Yeah.
No. No, that's one of the other things was, you know, those, they were just, I don't know, maybe I'm just waxing nostalgic here, or, you know, maybe, you know, talking about the good old days, but damn it, they were good old days. You know, sometimes the old days were good, you know, and I look back at those times, and I think they were darn good times. And we used to have more fun. I mean, everybody enjoyed things more. Now it's just a kind of a cutthroat, you know. Nobody seems to get along anymore. The civilities, you know, we're not as civil to each other as we used to be. I don't know. A little griping, I guess.
What were some of the big cases over the years, the important ones for you?
Well, let's see. You know, I left my scrapbook out in the car, but there were a number. I think probably one of the big ones I had after I, after I left the public defender, I went with, became a partner with Steve Cooper, who early went into politics pretty early on, and, you know, as he became the governor. But anyway, I was Cooper and Madsen for a while, and then when he, after a while, then it became, I was just on my own. But anyway, during that time, the pipeline days, of course, spawned a lot of litigation, a lot of cases, and a lot of criminal stuff. The Scotty Stone killing, I think, was one of the big ones. That was one where it was, must have been in late 70s, where Stone was just, somebody put a bomb in his car and blew him up. He lost a leg and an arm or something. He lost some limbs anyway, but he didn't die. Even though his car was blown to smithereens. Well, on about the fourth anniversary of his bombing, he was sitting in the cottage bar having a drink, and my client was sitting next to him, Bill Quinlan, when suddenly a shot was fired and Mr. Stone drops to the floor dead. Now, as you can imagine, you've got a bar full of people. Must have been 30 people in there. Nobody saw anything. Nobody saw a thing. But they eventually were able to put enough together to charge Mr. Quinlan with murder, even though he had no real motive. But they, but it was an interesting case because, you know, he did have a weapon, a .357 revolver, that when they searched his house, they found some shells for it, but they couldn't find the gun. And this is what makes, I think, the case so interesting, is that Quinlan was a heavy equipment operator for the Operators Engineers Union, and very good. He was extremely good. Lived all alone by himself in a little rented room. Didn't do anything with his money except his social life centered around the cottage bar, just sitting there and drinking. And he, when they searched his room, they found the ammunition, but not the gun. And I thought it was very critical that he'd have to explain why he had this ammunition. And if there was a gun, he said, well, I gave it to a friend. I mean, a friend gave it to me to hold. And at that time, he was a convicted felon. And if I testify, he's in trouble. I'll get him in trouble. And I said, you know, tell him, Bill, you can't worry about that. You got to worry about yourself. He said, well, I'll answer any questions but that. And I said, well, if you're on the stand, you can't pick and choose which ones you're going to answer. They're going to want to know where the gun came from, where it happened to this gun. And you're running a real risk if you don't testify, and because the jury's going to wonder about this, you know, and here you are sitting next to the guy, and he shot with a .357, and you had one, and he absolutely refused to testify. He would rather go to jail the rest of his life than to rat on a friend and get a friend in trouble for something like that. And I just, you got to admire someone like that, you know. He was acquitted, but it was just a real risky case. But that was one of them that I thought was interesting, very interesting case.
Was there anything in particular about the way you argued it?
Not that I can remember. It was one of those reasonable doubt cases. You know, there was certainly enough circumstantial evidence to show that, yeah, he was sitting right there. He was shot from that direction. People saw him leave right afterwards. Some witnesses said it looked like he was putting something inside of his coat when he left. And yeah, he was. He was putting his wallet and money away. But, I mean, it was, could be inferred that it was a gun. But it was those days. That's when the unions were really strong in Fairbanks, and a lot of corruption, especially in the Teamsters. And whatever the motive was for wanting Mr. Stone dead, I honestly don't. I have no idea. But somebody really wanted him dead, and they eventually succeeded. But the ones I can remember the best are the funny cases, you know, the ones that had humor to them, you know. But I had a lot of murder cases, you know, but most of them are pretty straightforward murder cases, you know. There was nothing terribly unique about them or anything, you know, that was...
But when you say funny cases, what do you mean by that?
Well, the ones that... Well, let me give you an example, I guess. Maybe the best thing is... One of them was a guy, and this is all part of the record, so I mean, I'm not disclosing any confidences here, but a guy by the name of Bjarne Arne, who is a Norwegian carpenter. He's dead now, but anyway, he was a Norwegian carpenter, and Bjarne liked his beer, and he used to go to the motel, the old motel, before it burned down. And he was there one night, and it got in the wee hours in the morning, and he got into his pickup truck and drove down, probably, I forget which street it was, the one right over here, a couple of blocks. Ends up right at the river, on First Avenue. And he's driving down there in the wintertime, and it's 40 below. He doesn't stop, goes through the guardrail, all the way down, the truck is upside down on the ice on the river. And Bjarne gets out of the truck and eventually makes his way up the bank into the waiting arms of the Fairbanks Police Department, who arrested him for DWI, and no surprise. So we had a trial, a jury trial, and Bjarne's defense was that he kept a bottle of brandy. He had a bottle of brandy that he used to play golf in the summer and played well into the fall at the old country club out here. And he used to keep a bottle of brandy with him, he said, because it took a little the edge off and, a little, you know, warm him up a little bit when he was out playing golf. And so he happened to leave it in the truck, and he remembered when he had the accident then, he tried to get up the bank, and he kept slipping and falling, and he was getting very, very cold. And he said, I remember the brandy. And then he went back and got the brandy, and just like Popeye and the spinach, just plugged her right down, you know. And lo and behold, he had the strength to get up the bank. And, of course, he had just... But the defense was he wasn't drunk when he ran into the river, or onto the ice in the river and through the barricade. He was totally sober. It was just afterwards that he became intoxicated. So we were... He was testifying, and he was relating all this, and... He was a funny guy, and anyway, he's telling the story about golfing and why he had the brandy there, and I couldn't resist asking him. I said, Mr. Arne, I said, maybe you could tell the jury something. I said, did the brandy improve your game? And he thought for a while, and he says, no, Mr. Madsen, but it sure did help me tolerate my errors. So anyway, the jury goes out, and they came back with a question. They had a written question. Did he have studded tires on his truck, and what size were the tires? And of course, this was totally irrelevant to anything, you know, and there was no evidence of it, so we just sent the note back and say, you know, we can't answer that, you know. So they immediately came back and said, not guilty. The jury got so mad because wouldn't answer the question. They just said, won't answer the question? Fine, not guilty. And that was one because he was such a character, you know, he just had everybody in stitches. And another one was Frank Stagno with the famous airboat case. Frank liked to have a beer or two at the motel, just as well as Bjarne did. And there were a bunch of airboaters who used to come there with their airboats, and they'd get talking, and, you know, and after a few beers, they'd get all kinds of ideas. And somebody bet Frank that he couldn't get his airboat to, forget which bar it was, but that bar wasn't on the river. That bar happened to be about a mile inland, but near the airport. And so that meant he was going overland on an airboat. Frank took the bet, went up the bank and scooted along the Airport Way, made a left turn, and he's going somewhere on old, all I guess was Old Airport Way, and there was the old motel there, the Monson Motel, I guess, was there. And it's like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And it just so happened there's a guy from Anchorage who's up here, never been here before, and was trying to find this motel. And he's driving along there, and he says, all of a sudden, he said, this big bright light, white light shining behind him, came by. He said, I was petrified. He said, I thought I got on the runway by mistake, and this plane was landing. And he said, it went by me, and it was an airboat past me. So he gets to the motel, stops in there, and then he tells the desk clerk, who then called the police. So the airport cops came out. In those days, they took things a little less seriously than they do now, because they found Frank sitting in a puddle there, cooling the bottom of his airboat off, because it was Teflon coated and it got so hot it was melting. So he's sitting there drinking a beer, and the steam is just pouring out all of it under his airboat. And they say, you know, hey, you're going to get this thing back to the river where it belongs. So they said, we'll hold up traffic on the Airport Way there, and you get it back. So unfortunately, when this went out over the air, you know, over the broadcast, every cop in town heard it. So naturally, every cop, highway cop, the troopers, all of them were there when C. Frank, and of course, there's 10 cops. And one of them had the audacity to arrest him for DWI, because Frank didn't quite make it to the place, but he almost did. And then our defense was that we had an odd statute at that time, because it said that if you could be convicted for operating a motor vehicle while intoxicated, but the definition of motor vehicle was something like it had to be a vehicle that was designed for and operated on land, or a vehicle that was designed and operated on water. And so I said, well, obviously this was designed to operate on water, but it was operating on land, so the statute doesn't apply. The judge didn't, and the jury didn't buy that argument. But I thought it was darn good.
Yeah.
But they didn't buy it, and Frank, we saved his license. But in fact, the law was changed because of Stagno's case, because at that time they couldn't suspend his license for operating a vehicle. Because it was a boat. I think that's correct. You didn't need a license for it. That's right. You didn't need a license to operate an airboat or any boat. So you couldn't suspend a license because one wasn't necessary. So they changed the law after that.
But so did he get fined, or?
Oh, he probably went to jail for a couple of days, or you know, whatever happened. I don't remember. Depending what the law was at that time, it changed so much over the years. Then, along as we're on that subject, another one comes to mind, the one I call the case of the disappearing pedestrian. Are we running out of tape?
We're fine.
The case of the disappearing pedestrian. Out at Pike's, one time, my client was there with a friend of his, and they had been there in two separate vehicles, and my client got very intoxicated, and they go to leave, and the friend says, I better drive you. He said, you've had probably too much. And he goes, no, I'm fine, I'll drive. So he says, okay, well, you stay right behind me, and I'll drive. And so they both take off. It's Halloween, and it had been a snowfall, and so there's a light snow, and it's dark, and it's a little snowing. And the first guy, the sober one, is driving along. He suddenly stops. So my guy pulls right up behind him and stops too, my client. And the guy comes back and says, I hit something. He said, I don't know what it was, but I hit something. My windshield's broken. I got a dented fender. And I don't know where it was. You know, they found a little blood or he did on the snow there. They looked all over, couldn't find a thing, and my client says, well, I don't know, I don't see anything, I want to go before the cops come. So he takes off, he just drives off, and he gets as far as the same motel, the Monson Motel, and for whatever reason, pulls in there, and he's on a little like slight grade with the car still in gear, and he passes out. And the troopers show up, and they look all over, and they cannot find anything, but obviously they found some blood and something was hit. They didn't know if it was an animal, they don't find any tracks, they don't find anything. So they trooper goes to radio in and get more help, and his radio is out. So he drives down to this motel where my client happened to be, pulls right alongside of him just to go in and use the telephone, and he hears this moaning, and he thought, what in the world? He goes over there and looks, and my client is passed out behind the wheel, car still in gear, and his engine still running. And he hears this moaning, he looks under the car, and here's this poor bugger in a Darth Vader costume who's laying under the car, who was the guy that was hit back there and drug a quarter of a mile by my car, who happened to scoop him up. He just drove over him, and then he was stuck under there. So he just drags him along the pavement, you know, that far. And the top half of him is got the muffler and the tailpipe burning him. So he's burned here, and he's freezing here. And I said, well, you know, if you take an average, somewhere in the middle, he's about right.
So, hang on a sec here.
On a dark night, and no wonder, I mean, he got hit. But, you know, the odd thing was here, he must have been laying there, and my client just drives right over him, and, of course, he gets hung up under the car. But that quarter of a mile ride must have been a real tough one.
Did he live?
Yeah, oh yeah, he lived. And I guess except for a few scars, he did very well.
And how did the trial come out?
Oddly enough, my client was only convicted of DWI and was not convicted of an assault for injuring him.
Huh.
Because the jury obviously believed that it could have happened. I mean, it just the way you said, that drunk or not, even a sober person may not have seen him on this black, you know, on the pavement, and just drove over him. And so they bought that argument.
But, well, you must have been good at arguing cases in court.
Well, I don't know about that. Some you win, some you don't. I mean, you know, I won some cases where I honestly thought the jury's got to be crazy. On the other hand, I've lost cases where I thought the jury was crazy. I mean, you know, you never know. That's the one thing that you lose control of a case when it goes to a jury, because you never know what those 12 people are going to do and what they're thinking. You know, up until that point, you have some degree or measure of control of what's happening in court. But once it goes to that jury and they start deliberating, I remember one case where a guy went to his neighbor because his, I don't know if it was some relative, a young girl was up there visiting my client. And he was concerned about her, and he came up there to say, I want, you know, send that girl home. I don't want her up here. I want her to come home. I think it was a stepdaughter, if I recall correctly. Anyway, the guy said, no, you got no business being here. Get off my porch. Go away. And the guy said, I want her to come out. And he was being very nice about it and everything. But he said, I want her to come with me home. They lived just down the street from each other, real close by. So my client comes out with a 12-gauge shotgun and says, I told you to leave, and boom, he blows a hole in him right through the middle of him. And the guy lived. I mean, how in the world he lived with a 12-gauge shotgun going off right through the middle, I don't know. But he did, and the jury came back with not guilty, and I could not understand that. I didn't think I had a prayer of winning that case. And maybe it was just that jury at that time just said, hey, he told him to leave, and the guy didn't leave, so gives you the right to shoot him, I guess.
How do you argue a case like that?
I was arguing, of all things, the protection of your own property and home, even though the victim had no weapon, no anything. It was a ridiculous argument. I told the guy he didn't have a prayer. You know, but you can't convince a client. Maybe people think that lawyers can make clients plead guilty or something. They can't. They could only advise them of what they think the best course of conduct is. And of course, I don't remember what the offer from the state was, but I just could see no way that a jury was ever going to find this guy anything but guilty. And they didn't. On the other hand, this case I'm still involved in right now, I don't see how in the world a jury ever found the kid guilty. It's just, you know, you just never know.
So what have you learned over the years? That's a hard one, I know.
What have I learned is that once it goes to a jury, it's flipping a coin. You never know. It's terrible to say. You think that geez, I made this great argument, I've done this great job, and I've convinced this jury. Well, I wish it was true, but it doesn't seem to work out that way. Maybe it does in some cases, but oftentimes it seems to be more of just what the jury, many times they go off on their own, you know. They don't trust the lawyers, and they want to solve the thing for themselves. And they lose sight of the instructions of what they're supposed to do as a jury, and that is simply listen to these facts, not second-guess anybody, but just listen to this and decide. And sometimes they don't do that, and that's what happened in this last case. And talking about other cases, one that came out the way it probably should have, for the most part, is the Hazelwood case, Joe Hazelwood in the Exxon Valdez. That was an interesting case from standpoint of if the state of Alaska, just like the federal government, decides to go after somebody, they have the manpower and they've got the resources, they can make life very miserable for you.
Were you involved in that case?
I represented Joe Hazelwood.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So tell us, are you at liberty to talk about that?
Oh, sure, sure. It's
yeah,
public record.
Let's talk about that. As a citizen, I have an opinion, of course, but from your standpoint, what was...
It was, well, what I think happened is that once the press got hold of the case, and he was alleged to be drunk or been drinking, that was all it took. And I think part of the problem was, or a decision-making process, was my ex-partner was the governor at that time, knowing Steve. Steve had a pretty good temper, and I could see that he said, this is... basically told the Attorney General's office to get that guy, you know, you get him, go after him, you know, and they did, and they went after him with everything. And, you know, here's a drunken captain supposedly steering this huge, you know, oil-laden vehicle, vessel down this dangerous narrows through there and runs it on a rock. Well, the truth came out, and eventually the jury, I think, was able to see this, and I think the press, too, after a while. It took a while. It took a lot of educating. But, you know, once you got past this DWI or drunk driving issue, which was absurd to begin with, is that it, you know, Hazelwood's defense made perfect sense. I mean, he, drunk or not, regardless of whether he'd been drinking or not, that may be an issue between him and his employer. But he got on board the vessel and he gave specific orders of what to do that were absolutely appropriate. He looked at the radar, saw there was ice coming from Columbia Glacier, told the second mate, who was perfectly qualified, and who was on the bridge at that time, he said, you take a heading 180 degrees south, 180 degrees, that's due south. You come a beam of whatever light it was, I forget, there's a light there. He said, when you're a beam, I mean you're 90 degrees off of it. He said, then take a course 10 degrees right rudder, which brings them back into the traffic lanes. You know, the Coast Guard had established. Mm-hmm. You can vary, you can go out of the lanes if the captain feels it's appropriate and proper, which in this case, there was no question that it probably was. So he goes down below, Hazelwood goes below, and here's a perfectly qualified second mate on the bridge with a helmsman who had the intelligence of a stone. I don't want to get into names, but this guy was really pretty thick. And all you got to know to steer this ship is, it's got a big wheel here, okay? All you got to know is your right hand, your left hand, and there's a big dial indicator up there. So you got to know, right, you go to the right. 10 degrees, you go until this big arrow goes 10. That's all you got to know. And for whatever reason, and this day remains totally unexplained, is the ship did not turn. The mate says he gave the order. The helmsman said he didn't hear it, and nobody told him anything. And the ship went straight, hit Bligh Reef, and there you are. And Hazelwood got the blame. And it was like, you know, my argument here, especially like DWI, he was charged with drunk driving. I got to go around the country talking about the world's greatest, the biggest DWI, you know, a 1,000-foot ship, you know, with the guy charged with drunk driving when he wasn't even there. I said, you know, it was like you taking a cab and saying, I'm in the back seat, and you tell the driver, go down here, and when you come to that stop sign, turn left. And the guy doesn't. He goes straight. And he runs into the woods. And they don't charge the cab driver. They charge you. They charge you in the back seat. And that's the only best analogy I could make. I say, what did I have to do with it? I gave a perfectly good order to somebody who was qualified to carry it out. And they screwed up. But they weren't charged at all. Neither one of them. And so because of that drinking aspect, he lost everything. He lost his career. He lost everything. And a little bit of black humor that nobody, I think, knows too much about was that this guy that was on the wheel, his name was Kagan. And like I said, he probably wasn't the shiniest little diamond in the bunch of jewels. Anyway, when the ship was on the reef, Hazelwood comes up and they try to get it off. He just wanted to see what the condition was. It reversed this way, that way. Nothing's happening. He said he knew he was there. He's not getting off. New oil was leaking. He knew the end of the world was, as far as he's concerned. Everything was a disaster. His career was over, everything. So he goes and shut her down, shut the engines down, put it on emergency power. So all the lights go down except the lights on the bridge. And he said, we're dim lights, the engine's off. And he said he happened to look over there, and this guy is still standing at the wheel like he's waiting for the next order. He said, I just went up to him, patted him on the back, and I said, nice job of steering, Kagan. And he said, looked at me and said, thank you, sir. Didn't dawn on him. Thank you, sir. But you know, a nice, interesting human interest touch to that is that this guy, when he testified, Kagan, when he testified at the trial, he told his story, and he told it very nice, but he got done, and he wasn't, the sharpest guy, Anyway, he finished testifying, and they said, thank you, Mr. Kagan, you're excused. He walked clear across the courtroom, clear over to our table, and shook hands with Joe Hazelwood, right in front of the jury. I mean, nobody knew what he was doing, Just came up and shook hands with him, and that, I think that told the jury that this guy had a lot of respect for him, because you could tell the guy was not, he was pretty slow. But that he really liked this guy who must have treated him nice. Mm-hmm. And I think the jury picked up on that, And it was just one of those little things that you don't expect, but it was very interesting. And Hazelwood himself is just one of the brightest guys I've ever met and one of the nicest guys I've ever known. A genuine, really nice individual, and well-read. I mean, he spends a lot of time on those ships, or did, and he read so many books. He was just knew so much. I was just amazed at how sharp he was.
Yeah, just as an aside, what's happening in his life now?
As far as I know, I get Christmas cards from him and occasional letters, but I think he's working basically just delivering yachts for rich people who want their yacht somewhere in the winter or in the Mediterranean or wherever, and he just takes it from place to place. Mm-hmm. He may also still be working for co-counsel in that case was, I can't think of his name offhand, but anyway, he does nothing but has a big firm in Manhattan, and they went to school together. And he hired Hazelwood to be kind of an expert witness in maritime cases. Mm-hmm. But he's behind the scenes. I mean, yeah. They don't use him as an expert witness, but behind the scenes stuff, Mm-hmm. He probably is still doing some of that, but I don't know for sure.
It sounds like analogy is an important technique that you used in your career.
Yeah. I think a lot of times people can understand it better if you put it in a different context, one that really makes sense, And that case, that jury came back with just that one little verdict, of what they call negligent discharge of oil, which is a Class B misdemeanor. That means it's one step up from a traffic ticket. And that judge did everything in his power to give him he gave him more than the maximum sentence. It was a ridiculous sentence. And our court failed miserably in that case when it was appealed. Our Supreme Court, I lost a lot of respect for them over that case because they twisted the facts, they twisted the law, they did everything to make that conviction stick. And it shouldn't have. It just shouldn't have. The judge gave the jury what's called a civil instruction. In other words, in a civil case where you're just talking about you know, should Joe Blow, is he responsible, and should he pay damages or money because of what he did, like a car accident.
Mm-hmm.
He gave that kind of instruction to the jury when the law at that time was absolutely crystal clear that it was a higher level of responsibility necessary before you could find somebody guilty of a criminal offense. You had to be, you know, kind of reckless rather than just negligent. And our courts upheld that with no trouble at all, because it was like we have to convict them of something. And it's one of those disillusioning things that a lawyer learns over the years, that judges are human too, you know, and for whatever reason they have their political agendas. And whether it's fear of being cut by the legislature when it comes to budget times, or pushing for another job in the federal bench, or whatever it is, they have their certain political agendas. And I think there was one there. But it was an interesting case. It was we had to go to San Diego to inspect the ship. And we were down there, and, you know, every lawyer for Exxon and all the oil companies and everybody and all the plaintiffs are all down there looking at this ship. And I thought, what the hell are we looking at down here? Something to do anyway. It was a fun, nice chance to get out of Fairbanks in the winter. So anyway, we're down there, and we're going through the captain's quarters down there, or Hazelwood's quarters. And, of course, this thing had been searched by the Coast Guard and by the state troopers and by everybody in the world. And here's 20 lawyers all milling around there, and I happen to notice the refrigerator. You know, so I just went over and opened it up. Of course, there's nothing in it. I just said, anybody want a beer? And you should have seen these guys look. It was just one of the greatest moments in my life. Beer in there? They didn't think it was too funny, but they didn't have much of a sense of humor anyway. And that's the thing I think is just important, you know, is just keeping a sense of humor. If you don't have that in this business, you better find something else.
Yeah. So you've maintained a sense of humor over the years.
Until I decided to quit, and I found that I wasn't happy anymore. I was mad most of the time. I was mad at somebody, mad at some other lawyer, mad at a client, mad at the judges. And I said, I don't want to go on like this. I never spent my life being angry and mad and upset. And I think it just, it's time to go, you know, because life's too short, you know. And sure enough, I think I got my perspective back again, and, you know, I'm starting to enjoy things again.
But you're back in the lawyering business.
Only for this one case, that's all. Otherwise, as you can see, this office is pretty bare. There ain't a whole lot of stuff on there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that one case.
Yeah. Are you at liberty to mention that case in general terms?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, in general terms, certainly. You've been here for a long time, and you must have followed the papers and that Hartman, you know, killing happened right out here, just right down the next block up on.
We're at 8th and Barnett here.
Yeah, we're at 8th. It was on 9th and Barnett where it happened. And anyway, the only witness to the whole thing was this guy who claimed he saw what happened to it, and the earlier time out there by the Eagles Hall, where a guy was assaulted and robbed just within minutes of the Hartman killing. And they, without any evidence at all, put the two together and said, well, if these guys did that one, then they must have done this one. And that was the theory of the case, was my client had a car, and he drove the three of them, there's four of them all together, and they assaulted and robbed this Andrew Dayton, and then drove up here and assaulted and killed Hartman just minutes later. But the case really hinged on a guy saying, this one guy who had been drinking and smoking dope, and he said, yeah, he had a real buzz and everything, and he was talking with all these people right outside the Eagles Hall at a break, and there's a whole number of people out there. Saw what happened at night 550 feet away and was able to identify all four defendants in a space of 3 to 4 seconds while they were running toward the car. Now, we had an expert witness who, you know, and a psychologist who said, this is impossible. It is frankly impossible. because, you know, his analogy, he did the same thing. He had a good analogy. He said, imagine yourself sitting in the end zone of a football game, halfway up the stands, and you look clear down the length of the field, halfway up the stands on the other side. That's about 550 feet. And you say, well, there's Joe over there. He says, you can't do it. It's impossible. The jury didn't buy it. You know what they did? They went out and did their own experiment in broad daylight, paced off a distance, and with one of them then walking up there and turning around and standing there, and they said, yeah, I guess you could identify him when the person was standing there a minute ago and walked up there. And, of course, they have no idea how far it was. They don't know. And it was broad daylight, not night. It wasn't drinking. I mean, they're totally unauthorized. They cannot do that. But they did. And so that's our latest appeal, is the unauthorized jury experiment.
And why do you think people choose you? Why do they seek you out?
I honestly don't know. I think a lot of it is, a lot of what, why people go to certain lawyers is, it isn't, to my opinion, it isn't advertising. It's mostly references from other attorneys. But, or else, even in jail. I mean, somebody's arrested and they're in jail. Maybe I've got a client there or something. And it's a reference. It's a word-of-mouth type of thing. Like, I know I got clients who came from other lawyers who don't do who didn't do criminal law, for instance. And they'd have a problem and they would call, you know, they'd send them over to here. And I think there's some references, even from cops. I've had references come from police officers. They come from different sources. I honestly don't know if there's one really answer to that.
But do you think, are there some qualities that people see in you?
I have no idea. The fact that I don't charge too much money probably is the only quality that I can think of, according to my wife particularly, says I never charge enough. And yeah, maybe so, but, you know, people can only pay so much, too. You know, if you can price yourself out of this market very quickly by charging more than people are able to pay. And I think if you charge a fair fee, and the chances are they're going to pay it, and they're going to, you know, it's easy to say, you know, here's how much it's going to cost and get the money up front, because in criminal cases, as a rule, you don't get paid afterwards. Win or lose, you don't get paid, and that's very true.
Yeah, but the impression I'm getting from what you said in the past hour is that money isn't what's driving you.
Money wasn't the big thing. I think I loved the courtroom. I really thought I was going to die on the courtroom floor.
And what is it you love about it?
The excitement of being in court, the challenge, you know, the fact that you've got a client who many times you have has a story to tell that you hope the jury is going to accept, and it's a challenge. It's an interesting challenge.
Well, you must be good at framing that challenge, framing that story.
Well, I don't know. Maybe in the last 2 years I felt like I wasn't framing very much of anything, but I don't know. I can't answer that, but I did enjoy it for many, many years, and looking back on it, I have to say that in retrospect, yeah, I did enjoy it, and it was just in the last year or so that we had some judges that were getting, you know, they awfully just fuddy-duddies, you know, it just wasn't fun being there. One in particular just made life miserable for everybody, you know. My last case happened to be in front of that particular judge, and it wasn't even a case. I was sitting here with a client, and I mistakenly believed it was to be at 3:30 when the hearing was at 3:15. And so telephone call comes, and this judge so-and-so and says, Mr. Madsen, get over here. We're waiting for you. So I take the client and go over there, and this judge kept the entire courtroom waiting, not doing a thing, had other cases to deal with and everything. Just sat there till I showed up to embarrass me, you know, and my client, or just embarrass me anyway, and I tried to explain what happened. We'll take that up afterwards. Then she makes me sit for the whole length of all the other proceedings. Well, she does that, and of course, I have no problem with that. And then we got all done, and then she was going to fine me, And then she said, well, I understand you're retiring, Mr. Madsen, so for that reason, I'm not going to fine you today. And I said, fine. They go off the record, and their in-court clerk, the gal who sits there and records everything like you're doing, kind of known her for years. And she just said, well, Dick, she said, you're really going to miss this, aren't you? And I said, Ann, I'm going to miss it like I'd miss a big oozing boil on my ass. And the judge looked at me like that. And she said, well, that's pretty graphic. And I said, that's the way I feel. That's how much I'm going to miss it. You know, because it was just so many unnecessary things like that. You know, sure, I deserved. I'm not saying I didn't deserve something, but to keep all these other people waiting in there and wasting their time and everything was totally unnecessary. To prove what point, I don't know.
So what are you going to do after this case?
I'll go back to living what I'm enjoying life. I mean, life's great. I love it. I'm still popping here once in a while in the summer, as long as I keep coming back and forth from Florida. And I'd stop in and see how things are going, and once in a while they pick my little brain and, you know, different cases, you know, and both Ken and Lori upstairs. And, you know, just to keep not a, maybe your big toe in it, you know, to see how warm the water is. But, yeah, just general interest. And still go to the bar conventions, and, you know, we still have a lot of friends who are still practicing, so we still see each other and everything. And what I'm going to do is I enjoy other things. There's a lot of other things you can do out there, you know. I love working on old cars, restoring them. It gets to be too expensive a hobby for retirement, but I love sailing. I like building sailboats. I like, you know, funny thing, after I kind of retired, I started doing carpentry work, you know, and I wasn't a very great carpenter, but I started doing things for my daughters. So one lives in Chicago and the other in Seattle. And, you know, I'd build something, you know, whatever it was. I redid what their kitchen in Chicago, and I had plenty of time, and I just got all the cabinets, and I redid the countertops, and did it all. And, you know, when I looked back at that, and I was done, and I said, geez, I did this. I never felt that way when I was trying a case. If you won, but it was a fluke, it was a jury, or you did your job, and you went on the next one, but I never had that feeling like I really accomplished something. And I thought, people work with their hands, you know, at least they have something they can look at and say, geez, I did that, you know? So that was kind of fun about, I rebuilt my sailboat here, and that was another thing I did. And you got it done, and it looked halfway decent, and, you know, it wasn't extremely professional, but it was nothing to be embarrassed about. And you think, God, I feel pretty proud of that, you know? So I admire people who can do things like that, real craftsmen. You know, in my opinion, they're every bit as good as any damn lawyer I've ever seen. We just work with different tools. We use our mouths, you know?
Well, I wish you luck.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think this has been good. I've enjoyed...
Oh, hope I haven't wasted your time.
No, not at all. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if we're back in another 5 years with you doing more stuff.
Yeah, well... Maybe it'll be more history by that time, and I, yeah.
Well, there's some history here. You've touched on some of the old-timers, and you've touched on some important historic cases, and you've given us a perspective as to how you work in the courtroom, and I think
that's stick
important.
Those tapes away, and maybe 50 years from now, somebody will dig them out and listen to them and say, oh, that's interesting.
I bet they will.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for doing it.
Mm-hmm.